People sometimes ask me if I became the Ron Van Dam Show announcer because I love what Ron does and I love his comedy. Well, no. It's because Ron broke me out of a Tijuana prison back in 82 and smuggled me across the border in a suitcase in the trunk of a Yugo. And I still owe him for that. Muchas gracias, mi amigo. You're listening to the Ron Van Dam Show on New England Broadcasting.
Good morning, good afternoon, good evening, good night. It's the Ron Van Dam Show.
Thank you.
Hold on tight. Things can get a bit weird if you like that sort of thing.
I don't know why I'm thanking you. I don't know what you did for me. Anyway, I have a special show today for you. As you know, every once in a while, you can't avoid the topic. You can't. It's the elephant in the room. And that is how the country seems to be so divided that it's basically unworkable. And that's unfortunate, and the people suffer, all for this struggle for power. Well, I have an interesting guest today. He joined me a couple of years ago, and the topic is just as bubbly, if not more so, than it was even then. He's an expert in the field. We're going to talk about the division in this country, which is unbelievable, and the fact that it can be quite destructive to democracy. Where is democracy going? Is it hanging by a thread? Scary, but true. So, let's speak to our guest right now. Seth David Radwell joins us now. He's an author, a great new book, American Schism. And it's available now. It's How the Two Enlightenments Hold the Secret to Healing Our Nation. Book couldn't come at a better time because this is the crux of everything that everybody's talking about. When you watch the news pundits on all the analytical stations, our democracy is falling apart and we're spiraling into the depths of hell. Does seem like it, but not necessarily the case. Thanks for being with us today, Seth.
Oh, Ron, it's a pleasure to be here. Thank you for having me.
What inspired you to write this book, and during what period of time did you actually do this?
So this has been an endeavor over the last 2.5 years. You know, most of my career has been in business. I've been a CEO and heads of various companies. But I watched over the last few years as our political discourse has absolutely collapsed. And, you know, any notion of our reasoned debate has been crowded out by rancor and acrimony. And so as I watched this, I increasingly became convinced that we needed a better way. And, you know, I found that, Ron, that many of my colleagues in my professional network, whether they were on the right or the left, they were putting their heads in the sand because they didn't want to deal with the political arena because it had become so crazy. So I started this investigation because I believe there's a better way. And that's what led to this research and to American Schism.
Let's start with where it's actually at. The attitude of the public and even politicians are that we're just not working together. There are two distinct parties. They are split. They vote on their side and do not cross. Otherwise, they are either threatened or removed. It seems like we're just done. We're just that this democracy doesn't seem to be happening. Biden comes in and decides that I have a history of bringing the two sides together, but it doesn't seem to be working because the divisions are so deep. And I guess that's where people are putting their heads in the sand. Is that necessarily the case?
Well, no. It is the case that we're extremely divided. But here's the key thing, Ron, is that this is not new. We have had political divisions over the course of our history many times. And, you know, what's different about today is that we're caught in what I call two bubbles. Sometimes you hear, and you mentioned, I think, this partisan bubble, how we've got two sides, red and blue, and however you want to distinguish it, but we listen to our own news, etc. So it's true, we're in a partisan bubble, but we're also in another bubble. We're in a time bubble. In other words, we discuss issues today without really understanding how they've evolved. And I believe that there are two things we need to do. We need to break out of both of those bubbles. And we do that by rejecting the self-imposed prison that we've created by our mobs. Everyone's afraid to speak against what their chosen mob pretends to believe, mm-hmm. or to think. And that's a prison that we put ourselves in. Secondly, I think that we believe everything going on today is unique. And what I've done in the book, American Schism, is do an investigative tracing of the roots of our division, which goes back to our founding. And I found some incredible things that I think that historical perspective, mm-hmm. could be a salve for our woes today. So in summary, I'm asking people to take a different approach to discourse today, to fight unreason with reason.
Mm-hmm. That makes sense. The history of discourse is fascinating, and I know that runs through the book, so that we understand that this is not the first time any parties have had this amazing disagreement and split down the middle. But there is something a little bit different around this time, as you point out also, that there's another thing at play, and that's called the truth. And this is kind of odd, this being brought up into how we live these days.
Absolutely. In fact, that is what is distinct about today, is that over the course of our history, you know, there's a reason the book is about the Enlightenment, because mm-hmm. the Enlightenment, which is a term that's out of our vernacular today, it's not in favor. But in fact, the Enlightenment, which we can talk more about, was what birthed our nation. Mm-hmm. And what happened based on Enlightenment reason and objective thinking, what you call objective truth, is that we've always thrived on divergent views. We act as if this divergent views that we have today is terrible. In fact, divergent views are how the U.S. should run is what's allowed us to succeed. Mm-hmm. But what's different about today, if we reject objective truth altogether, mm-hmm. democracy as a form of government is doomed. Mm-hmm. And so what's different about today is over the course of our history, in the debate, there's always been a mingling of passion, emotions, and truth. But today, it's gotten more and more tilted to rejecting objective truth. And a democracy can't function that way. So that is what's unique about today. And that's why, again, the Enlightenment is so important. In fact, what the book does is really go back to understanding that the Enlightenment was really made up of different movements. And there were two distinct schools that affected our founding. That pinned, if you will, some founders against the others. You're the moderates and the radicals, right, as I describe in the book. And that difference, those distinctions that were made back in the 18th century, are actually at the root of many of our differences today.
Do you agree that it is our own media that has kind of made this difficult? For example, when I was growing up, there was Walter Cronkite. He was the truth. There was nothing else. He didn't analyze anything. He just reported things that were verified, and the public made up their own minds. We didn't have a place to go to exercise our cult feelings, such as either Fox or MSNBC, whatever your choice is. These are cult camps. Unfortunately, we have the internet, which gives us multitudes of different viewpoints that are totally made up, and people just fall into it. The truth seems to be whatever you want the truth to be. And that is indeed, as you bring up in the book, that's the different part of this.
Yes, it's different, and it's there are antidotes that are out there which we have to focus on. For example, your show. Being on a show where you can discuss issues that are nuanced is part of the solution, as opposed to shouting at each other on Twitter. What I describe in the book is that this rejection of objective truth, what I call this postmodernism, where everyone can have their own truth, it comes out of this what we call identity politics, where people react emotionally based on a knee-jerk reaction of a feeling they get, which frankly is based on primitive drives, endorphin rushes that go back to in millennia in terms of being adaptive for the human species. We know this because it's how we approach rooting for sports teams. If you go into a sports arena, you feel that emotional rush of attacking the other side. And my point is, though, of course, those are human drives, and they're fine for the sports arena, but they're no way to conduct public policy. And we have to understand that we, again, because of our enlightenment inheritance, of our ability for reason and empirical observation, we need to foster people evaluating data and making their own point of view intelligently, as opposed to always reacting emotionally. And we've done this over the course of our history. There are times when, I'll use one example, which I go into in the book. If you look at immigration, which is a very emotional issue, and the last couple of years we've heard about, you know, build walls and cages and all this craziness. In not that long ago, Ron, in 2013, the Gang of Eight on the Hill had a framework that made a lot of sense for how to fix immigration. And it wasn't perfect. No side was completely happy.
Right.
Had some real solutions, again, that, you know, so those on the right might have thought weren't great, because they had, did have a pathway eventually for citizenship for dreamers. And those on the left might not have liked it so much, because it had control and regulation of immigration and numbers and quotas and things like that. My point being is that rational solutions are on the table if we search for them. But if we continue to feed our endorphins with this this attacking approach, this knee-jerk reaction, we really can't have a democracy. And that's that. I go into that in some detail in the book.
You started writing this book during the Trump administration, time-wise, and I'm wondering, not to get into that because I hate to talk about that subject matter, but at the same time, was that man successful in digging into the psyche of the disgruntled American, and thus we end up in this arena?
Yes, this is also a topic of the book, because what I point out in detail after going through the founding era, I then trace through various eras of our history. And the answer to your question is, Trump is not responsible for all the division we have today, but he figured out how to capitalize on it, how to use it and manipulate it. And in that way, he was a master. But the resentment and the anger has been brewing for decades. And, you know, you saw it over the course, I mean, you know, when Hillary Clinton referred to the basket of deplorables, or when Mitt Romney talked about the 47% takers. I mean, our politicians on both sides have shown a disdain for Americans who are really suffering. And this is discussed as well in the book, because in the last 50 years, some Americans have had much more of a difficult time than others. And our politicians and our political system has been deaf to their concerns. And that is not a Trumpian thing. That's happened for, I could go back and really since Nixon and Reagan and many previous administrations. The point being, Trump figured out and how to use that, as great demagogues do. They find ways to press people's buttons. And so that's when you refer to cult-like following. And it's gotten more intense. But the book traces it back and shows that he by far didn't create it.
No question. But you're right. He was a master in taking people's heads and putting them in a different place, and still continues to do so. But now it's an entire party and an entire split in the American people where they're actually following that. I always say, damn the internet. And it's, I know it's a wonderful tool and it's fantastic and it's changed our lives technologically, but it's also causing some great destruction. I don't know if you get into that, but I think this is a lot of the blame on this is again taking human beings and throwing them into a cult mix.
Well, so I would agree with you, but I think there's cause for hope, and here's what it is. My research shows that over 77% of Americans are part of what I sometimes refer to as the frustrated majority, meaning there are people, even if they're left or right, they believe they're somewhere close enough to center to believe that the extremes are not helpful.
Right.
And that frustrated majority believes that we have more in common that tears us apart. And here's what's happening. The frustrated majority is getting really disgusted at the rejection of truth. So for example, I think both extremes are to blame for some of our woes, but I think the complete rejection of objective truth on the right is, on the extreme right, is extremely dangerous. That is, in fact, tempting the Republican Party overall. Mm-hmm. What's going on in Arizona now is, to count votes for the 19th time after we've been through, 18 counts have shown what the data say. Mm-hmm. And the fact that we keep pursuing things like that, I think, is extremely frustrating to many Americans. Now, one of the reasons why, you going back to a question you asked me when we started, I wrote this book because I don't want my colleagues, and I have a big network within the business world, I'm not so much in the political world, but the point is, other professions outside of politics need to wake up and start speaking about this, as opposed to keeping their head in the sand. Mm-hmm. And what I mean by that is that I think the political industry, there's a great book by Catherine Hale and Michael Porter called The Politics Industry, which shows how the whole political system has become self-supporting and almost like a monopoly, and how they control this dialogue. Mm-hmm. And in fact, this bitter rancor helps ensure that they stay in power. But we don't put up with this kind of thing in business, nor do we do it in law or medicine or other professions. And professional people, if we care about giving a democracy to our children, we better wake up and stop keeping our head in the sand and start talking about how we cannot have a governing society that rejects truths.
Well, yeah, very, very much like Trump, the dictatorships around the world have also noticed a weakness and an ability to sneak in there while the going's bad, and that's also being played against us. So what you're talking about is, like, better wake up, because, if you don't, you see what happens.
Right. This is also discussed in part of the book, in that we Americans take democracy for granted.
Yes.
We don't realize, but it's definitely hard work. It's not the easiest system.
Mm-hmm.
And this is not just an American thing. To your point, it's a trend around the world to follow autocrats. But in fact, there's a great researcher at Harvard, Danielle Allen, who's done a lot of work explaining really what democracy is all about and how it's about listening. There's a great analogy here, Ron, if I could.
Yes.
In 2000, I forget what year it was, maybe 16 or 18, after a Republican win in a midterm, I think it was, our majority leader of the Senate, Mitch McConnell, famously said, in politics, what happens is the winners, elections matter. The winners make policy, the losers go home.
Right.
That was his quote. That is, in fact, according to people who really study how democracy works, that is the antithesis of what democracy is. And what I mean by that is, the way democracy works is, elections do have consequences. The winners get to chair the conversation. But the first thing the winners need to do is invite the losers back in and talk with them. The notion of losers go home is not how democracy works.
Right.
In fact, it's ironic in some ways that almost every president in modern times that's been elected, what's one of the first things they do on their acceptance speech?
They say that they're going to work together.
They invite people who didn't support them
to give them a chance. To come on board, right.
Right. This is the first time that I can remember since I've been watching politics that in the Trumpian years, that didn't happen.
Correct.
So, but I think to go back to your great point is that to really make a dent in fixing this, it's going to take both top-down leadership, and I think I think President Biden is trying that. We'll see if he succeeds.
Right.
But it's also going to take bottom-up movement. And the reason why I wrote this book was to make a small contribution in terms of these bottom-up movements, getting people to wake up and stop ignoring what are in essence threatening aspects to our current society, which may in fact impede the future of our democracy.
Right. Well, the truth actually exposes itself constantly. McConnell, not long ago, said the main focus of our Republican Party is to make sure that the Democrats fail and that their administration fails completely, instead of saying The Republicans are for the people, and we want the people to win, and we're going to work accordingly. That's a truth stated right in front of your face.
Exactly. And that's what I mentioned in that book, The Politics Industry. It shows how the system in politics, the incentive system, mm-hmm. has been for politicians, especially federal politicians, in Washington, to stay in power. And through things like gerrymandering, but also through the way political contributions work, it's about keeping discord going as opposed to solving problems.
Right.
You know, there's another interesting part that I go into in the book, which I think is again, why historical perspective is so important. And it talks about the period between the Declaration of Independence and mm-hmm. the Constitution.
Mm-hmm.
And the Constitution was a great set of compromises that really moved the Republic, the early Republic, closer to the moderate Enlightenment ideal as opposed to the radical one, which we should come back to if we have time because it's important. Point being, it was full of compromises, but the founders and the framers knew that it would have to evolve, which is why they made it amendable. It was supposed to be changing over time when things didn't work. And, we haven't amended the Constitution since 76, I think it was, or 77. Yeah. There are things that have to change. And the third part of the book lays out a couple of proposals that include bottom-up dialogue like we're having right now, mm-hmm. but also some structural changes that need to happen.
I don't think Americans understand why there isn't a third centralist party. They all mm-hmm. pretty much figure that would be the answer to everything. But at the same time, right. you have both Democrats and Republicans trying to destroy you. So you're being ganged up from both ends. But that does seem like that would be an attractive resolve.
Yes, and there are very practical things that can do to foster that and get more opinions in the mix. Mm. One of them is that in today's modern times in America with two parties only, and because of the way our voting systems work, any third candidate in a major election is usually seen as a spoiler.
Mm-hmm.
So in other words, someone comes in with a different set of ideas, and because they're not established and supported by one of the two major parties, all they do is disturb the results. Well, in proportional voting systems, ranked choice voting, there's a way to get many more opinions involved. And, you know, this has been experimented with in democracies elsewhere, and it seems to foster more legitimate points of view in the argument. And the way that works is simply that there could be five or six candidates, and after the top two go to the next round, and the ones who fall out, their votes get reallocated based on the order of preference.
Mm-hmm.
And this is a system that has been proven to take more of the people's will into account, because people not only vote for their first candidate, but through ranked choice, if the first candidate is not one of the top two, who would they then prefer? So, systems like that, where they seem to be a little bit complex, but in fact, they're very effective at fostering not just two political parties.
Hmm. Your background in business is extensive. Your knowledge in democracy is extensive. I'm going to ask you a question here. Business operates in the sense of you have someone at the top, and they make the final decisions. I'm not saying that businesses are dictatorships, but they are not structured in a democratic sense where all the employees vote as to where the company should be going next year or the fiscal year. So I think Trump actually latched on. That's why he became friends with Putin and others, because he sees this model of one person making all the decisions, and that's the way things should be run. Those are dictatorships, obviously. How does our democracy differ from that? I know not all companies run in that sense. They do listen to their employees. They are the successful ones. That's probably the answer. But maybe that's why we're heading toward an area where there's just someone at the top and you listen to what they say. Because it does seem more efficient.
It is more efficient in many ways, but there are two answers to your question. The first one is that, yes, it seems that in business, for example, there's a quote-unquote dictator, but that's mm-hmm. not actually true.
Mm-hmm.
There are constituents, which include the customers and the shareholders and mm-hmm. the employees,
mm-hmm.
which all have needs and claims on the activities of the business. So obviously, the CEO, who seems like a quote-unquote dictator, has to return has to provide financial return to his or her shareholders. Mm-hmm. But if they do so at the expense of the customer satisfaction, customers won't buy their products. Mm-hmm. And there are different constituencies that need to be balanced. Mm-hmm. So while seemingly a dictatorship, it actually in many ways is not. Now, the second part answer to your question is a little bit more nuanced, which is this. It appears that it's more efficient to have someone call the shots. Mm-hmm. But the first question that we have to ask ourselves, and I call this one of, in the book, I go into three fundamental questions that are more basic than any other. And the first one of those questions is, do we believe in a bottom-up form of government of the people? Mm-hmm. Because while it's not the most efficient, it's the most, without using a fancy term, it's epistemologically superior. What do I mean by that? It means it creates, it allows people to gain knowledge, as opposed to things being handed down, what you're seeing happening in China and Russia now. In our system, and this goes back to the radical enlighteners that I talk about in the book, they believe that the Enlightenment unleashed the human capacity of every person to think and reason. Mm-hmm. And democracy is a system in which we get to think and reason, but it requires civic education. It requires the ability to evaluate evidence and to make an argument and to listen. And those things, to your point, are not always the most efficient, but I believe they lead to a better, ultimately, mm-hmm. a better solution. Now, mm-hmm. it's not what I believe. It's what American people believe.
Right.
Do we want, even though it's harder, a bottom-up form of representative democracy as our government? If mm-hmm. we want to move towards an autocracy, or in fact, today I would argue we're moving closer to a plutocracy, where mm-hmm. the wealthy really run the country because of yes. their, for various reasons.
Yes.
So we want to let the wealthy be the government, then the government's not going to be for all the people.
Right.
It's going to be for some of the people.
Right.
And I think that's a question that we have to answer and debate seriously.
Well, although going back to your previous point, the wealthy are wealthy because they did listen in business and in their money financing. They did listen to the people, and they did have to move according to the waves of comment. So, in a sense, they can be very caring as well. Let me ask you one more question here, and it's the bottom line question, I suppose. Why do you think that the American public was so disgruntled? Why are they so disgruntled? Is it fear? Is it indeed racism? I mean, what brought this out with Trump? What was happening inside the American people? I sometimes think it's stupidity, but I don't think that's the answer.
Yeah, I think that there's something that we don't talk much about, which mm-hmm. is the last 50 years of American policy, which in economic terms has been, it's called neoliberalism. Mm-hmm. It's basically, it's fostered global competition and competitiveness with the least amount of government regulation possible. And without getting into the merits of that system, which we've, by the way, both parties have followed, mm-hmm. the end result is that it's been very unequal. So Americans are affected, for example, coastal quote-unquote elites mm-hmm. have done very well, people who are educated and who live in booming right. towns and technology hubs. Mm-hmm. And many other Americans, especially in rural areas and not on the coast, have suffered enormously. Mm-hmm. And they haven't done well. And this system of neoliberalism or global capitalism has left them behind. And it's been progressive over 50 years. Let me give you one last analogy, Ron. Mm-hmm. One of the great examples of this is what happened in the aftermath of the Great Recession of 2008. So here was an incredibly difficult economic time for the country, which was really caused by these quote-unquote elites on the coast in finance ripping off Americans. And, you know, everyday Americans from the working classes and middle classes watched as these elites not only cheated the system, but they were not held accountable. And whereas normal working class Americans who were playing by the rules, they lost their homes and they had tremendous financial hardship. Mm-hmm. So it was, to me, it was an encapsulation of the fact that we really have two different systems here. We have the system of law and order for the rich, and then a system of regulations and of law and order, if you will, and rules for the not so rich.
Right.
And they're different. And that's a problem. That answers your question of what's progressively created this rage.
Yes, but then the real disgruntled ones were the Republican conservatives who did have the money, and the less fortunate people were thrown at the bottom by that party, where the Democrats are more progressive. So it seems like it flipped there. It seemed that the disgruntlement was on the wrong side.
Let me try to see if I could help it, because this is a confusing thing, and many people have asked me about this, and I go into it in the book.
Uh-huh.
Over the course of history, and this is why history is so important, there are often various coalitions that manage for power. So back before the Enlightenment, in all through the Middle Ages, there was a coalition between the monarchy and nobility. They made a deal with the church. And together, those two aspects of society kept everyone else in check. So what happened in modern day, and I describe this in detail in the third part of the book, there's a coalition between the very wealthy, the 1%, and the base of the Republican Party, which is supporting of fundamental equity issues that they feel they've been left behind. So it used to be that the working class party used to be Democratic.
Right.
That's flipped now. The Democratic Party is that of the elites and the educated, quote unquote. So there's been a coalition, if you will, an ability for the Republicans have been very clever at doing, which allows that the wealthy to write the laws based on the contributions they give.
Yes.
But they have a problem, which is those laws are not in the interests of normal people.
Correct.
So they need another mechanism to amass the vote, to build the base.
Yeah.
And the way they do that is by using wedge issues or emotional issues, whether they're about race, whether there are ways that they scare
fear.
The populace.
These scare. That's it. Fear. Yeah.
And it's not new. This populist arguments have, you know, one of the aspects of the book is the discussion of what populism is.
Yeah.
Is populism a good or bad thing? I mean, in some ways, it's ironic. You would say having people involved in who they select for government, being involved in politics, is a good thing. When Aristotle discussed, populism, he didn't use that term. There were aspects of it that are very important. But populism in our context today is when people are frankly manipulated and scared emotionally for the benefit of someone else.
Correct.
And usually for the benefit of a politician to get elected. So I do believe that when I say this coalition, I think the wealthy the Republican Party is in the middle. They realize they need the money from the wealthy, but they need the votes from the people.
Mm-hmm.
And they figured out a way to get both.
Yeah. I just, when you talk about the truth, I remember when Trump did did the tax cuts for the wealthy, and he actually had some of them in the Oval Office and made the statement, and I'll never forget the statement, "I just made you guys a lot of money." And I thought, are people listening to what he just said?
Right.
I mean, seriously.
That's a great example.
Yeah.
That's a good, because he got, how did he get so much, 81 million people to vote for, in essence, what was against their economic interests?
I
mean,
it's
amazing that the Republican Party has managed to pull that off.
Yeah.
And by the way, Trump's not the first one to do this. Mm. This goes back to Lee Atwater, and who recognized that the evangelical Christians and conservative Americans, which often were previously quote unquote Democrats or liberal, they were available to be convinced, not with economic arguments, but with other, let's call them socio-political arguments.
Yeah.
And, part of what allowed that to happen, starting really in the 80s or even before, was that the prevalence of economic issues being front and center receded to the background. It used to be that unions were prevalent and union, economic issues were front and center. How does a family put bread on the table?
Mm-hmm.
And that's still important, of course.
Sure.
But to some degree, that's been crowded out by, other emotional issues about who's American.
Exactly. Right? We could talk forever, but I don't think we should.
Well, I'd love to come back. I think as I mentioned before, this is the anecdote to discuss these things, and I hope people will turn to American Schism. I think it's enlightening, and it's not intended to be for the left or the right. It's really an appeal to rationality.
Well, it answers many questions, and that's what's been happening here, and it brings to light, as you say, what's going on, and that's necessary. It's American Schism, How the Two Enlightenments Hold the Secret to Healing Our Nation. It's available everywhere, and it's an important read because it does clear up your head, and man, do we need the head clearing, and that's what this book does. Is there some way people can follow you?
Yes, so AmericanSchismBook.com has more information about the book, but I'm also, Seth David Radwell. I have a Facebook and Twitter profile, and at AmericanSchismBook.com, they can also email me. But I'd love to help talk to readers and listeners, because I am trying to create this bottom-up movement of people really reflecting. And one of the things I did in the book, Ron, was try to make it very approachable. So while it takes on some big topics and some philosophical ideas, it does so in a way that's accessible, I think, for everyone.
Perfect. Well, we'll talk again in the future, and thank you so much for your time and continued success. Well, good luck to us all, I must say. I'll be back again tomorrow with a brand new program, but until that time arrives, I wish you peace.